Tonight our speaker is Kristen Dawkins, who received her graduate training in city planning, and she specialized in international environmental negotiation at the Massachusetts Institute for Technology. She has a long history as an activist. She worked with groups such as the Pennsylvania Energy Ratepayers Coalition and Community Labor Alliance. She served 9 years as executive director of the Philadelphia Jobs and Energy Project and worked at the Harvard Law School Program on Negotiation. She's presently at the Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy in Minneapolis, Minnesota, where she directs the Institute's Trade and Agriculture Program. The name of her talk tonight is Agriculture and Biotechnology, Battle Royale of the 21st Century. So please help me welcome tonight Kristen Dawkins.
I'm really, really delighted to be here. You know, when Jack called me, maybe 2 months ago or so, and invited me to be the C.P. Snow lecturer this year, I actually am ashamed to admit that I didn't know very much about C.P. Snow. I had heard of him, but darned if I could have said anything about what he stood for or the importance of his work. But I decided I better do a little bit of research if I was going to do a good job in delivering the C.P. Snow lecture. And so I went out and found Two Cultures, The Two Cultures. I guess it's perhaps his most famous piece of work. He's also done a lot of writing of novels and other forms of literature. And as I began to familiarize myself with it, I realized that I had read one of his books, 10 years since. I'm kind of an addict of murder mysteries, and it turns out that he had written at least one. His very first novel was a murder mystery. It's called Death Under Sail. He wrote it when he was 26 years old, and I'd read it ages ago without realizing that I was actually reading literature. It was republished in 1959, the same year that The Two Cultures was published. And in a little introduction that he wrote for the new edition, he said the following. He said that having partially escaped at the age of 26 to write this book, having partially escaped from the scientific trap, I was being lured into another. There were all sorts of temptations put in front of me to get me to set up as a detective story writer. Well, the moral of The Two Cultures, as I'm sure you know and was presented more or less in the beginning, is that scientists and literary people, philosophers, the other professions, the other disciplines, don't talk to each other. And he goes further to say that they don't know how to talk to each other, that they essentially talk different languages. And they also have different motivations and different interests, profoundly different orientations to the world. And he does a very, very interesting job of developing that analysis. And he says that that problem is at the heart of the problems that our society faces today. Well, it actually rang true in many ways to me. And I've been thinking about it ever since. But there was one part of that lecture, The Two Cultures, that to me rang truer than the rest of it. And it was the little section called Rich and Poor. And I think this is what probably drives my work. It's the concern that I have for the poor in the world, the suffering in this world, the incredible injustices that are just part of life. And we are able, those of us who are privileged enough to have a decent quality of life, to be able to care about it when we see it and then go on our way, give 50 cents to a homeless person, or read the newspaper and really be upset, but life goes on, sure enough. Well, in his Rich and Poor section of this 1959 lecture, he said something that really caught my eye. He said, "The disparity has been noticed between the rich and poor, most acutely by the poor. Whatever else in the world we know survives to the year 2000, that won't. Once the trick of getting rich is known, as it is now, the world can't survive half rich and half poor. It's just not on." Well, here we are in the year 2000, And that particular prediction has not turned out to be true, unfortunately. Now, the trick that he was referring, from my reading of that lecture, the trick he was referring to as how to get rich had to do with science, technology, and industrialization. But he then also adds that there needs to be political will and investment. So I think it's fair to say we have plenty of science and technology and industrialization. In fact, we're seeing some problems from industrialization that were probably not very familiar to people in 1959, serious problems like climate change or the loss of species, disruption of our endocrine systems, immune system failures, and so forth. But we can clearly say that there is still a lack of political will, and the investment has not been made. According to the United Nations, more than 800 million people around the world live in poverty. Since 1982, when the so-called debt crisis was first recognized, the southern countries, the developing countries of the world, are 61% deeper in debt now than they were in 1982. If you add up the fortunes of Bill Gates, Warren Buffett, and Walmart, if you add up their annual incomes of these three individuals, Walmart's heir, whose name is S. Robeson Walton, those three men on an annual basis take home more than the entire economy of the 43 least developed countries in the world, with a population of 600 million people between them. So there is some severe disparity between rich and poor that is arguably quite a bit worse now than it was in 1959, when C.P. Snow was so concerned about it. One of the international conferences that I went to, and I go to a lot of them, was in 1995 in the city of Copenhagen. It was called the World Summit for Social Development. It was a United Nations conference, and the objective there was to try to develop that political will for the world to, and here was one of the big debates, alleviate poverty or eradicate poverty. Now, guess what side the United States government was on? It argued, it spent days arguing that no, they couldn't sign any document that said that the goal was to eradicate poverty. They insisted, and they won. And the final text of that particular international conference reads that, you know, the world will all cooperate to alleviate poverty. When the World Trade Organization was during the negotiation phase, it was formed in 1994. Before that, it was something called the GATT, the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade. And there was an 8-year negotiating process called the Uruguay Round Negotiations. And during that Uruguay Round 8-year period, there was a lot of talk about how free trade is going to raise all ships and that it's going to bring about more economic activity, which would trickle down and enable the entire world all over to improve the welfare and standard of living of our peoples. This raising all boats on the tide of prosperity idiom was talked about quite a lot. Now we have, since 1994, 5 or 6 years of experience. And those of us who were skeptical about that prediction can now say with accuracy that we were right, and that was a false prediction. The surveys and economic studies that can be made across the board show that Africa in particular is significantly worse as a result of the specific terms in the Uruguay Round agreements. And Asia went through, as you know, that financial crisis 2 years ago or so, which wasn't specifically due to the Uruguay Round, but nonetheless, there is a globalized economy, a highly integrated economy. Trade and finance are inextricably linked, so you can make an argument that it also has improved conditions in Asia or in much of the world. You can do that by geography, you can do that by national aggregate statistics, and as we've already discussed, you can certainly do that by seeing that the vast majority of people worldwide are poorer than they used to be. all of this is part and parcel of why the meeting in Seattle in December last year was such an extraordinary phenomenon. People are simply tired of watching the poor get poorer and the rich get richer. And you could get into all kinds of very technical discussions about the specifics that were on the negotiating table in Seattle. And of course, there was the labor issues, which got a lot of play in the press and were extremely central. I would say probably the most central issue to the failure of that meeting. There was all the environmental stuff. There was a lot of argument inside the meeting room that had nothing to do with the actions of citizens in the street, by which the wealthy countries did most of the negotiating behind closed doors in secret, while Africa was left outside sitting around in the waiting rooms wondering what was being decided on their behalf. All of that contributed to the failure of the Seattle talks. But it has become more than the specifics of that particular meeting. It has now become a symbol of all of humanity, all of us, all over the world who object to the state of the world, coming together to say we need fundamental change, we need a restructuring of our economy, and we need to take all of this very, very seriously. We're not just going to let it drag on and on as has gone on for so many years, at least 41 since C.P. Snow noted it. Our Secretary of Agriculture from the United States Department of Agriculture, Dan Glickman, in 1997 said that the battle royale of 21st century agriculture is going to be around the issues of biotechnology and the patenting of life. In 1997, in this country, there was very little awareness about genetic engineering and genetically engineered foods. It was beginning, just barely beginning, to develop in Europe. Now, in Europe, it's full-scale warfare, and in this country, it's beginning to catch on. We're having a lot of skirmishes in this country. People are just beginning to pull up crops. The media is just beginning to write articles about it. It's just beginning to catch on here. But what is really at stake is something like $20 billion worth of investment dollars that the private sector is seeking to invest, Wall Street money. They want a 20% return on those investments in order to be viable as major corporations in today's economy. And so that's what's driving a lot of the phenomenon that we see, this insistence on getting these products to market before they've been tested, before the public knows, before they've been labeled, before there's been adequate evaluation of the benefits, let alone the costs. There's a lot of talk about whether or not the European rejection of genetically engineered foods, foods that are grown in the United States and exported to Europe, ships being blocked in harbor, customers going straight to the supermarket owners and saying, don't put this on their on your shelves, and winning those battles, directly market-driven responses to our attempts to sell these products in Europe. There's a lot of speculation, let's say, that the United States will take Europe to the World Trade Organization's dispute settlement process to win a legal judgment that the European Union's national laws and the European-wide policies are barriers to trade and illegal according to WTO law. Now, whether or not that happens remains to be seen. It hasn't happened yet. But there is a case that's worth understanding that really sets the framework and lays out the issues in a way that makes it quite clear what could happen. As you may or may not know, in 1987, the European Union banned the import of beef from the United States or from any other country, but it's all coming from the United States, that has growth hormones, artificial growth hormones in it. And there's some evidence that the accumulation of these growth hormones in the human being leads to various health problems, including, most strikingly, early puberty in, I suppose, boys and girls, but in young girls it's quite noticeable. And this is just one reason why they have banned these the beef. Now, I suspect that there are also protectionist interests. I'm not trying to say that there aren't. By all means, Europe is as interested in its beef production and economy as we're interested in our beef production and economy. It stands to reason. But the public there also has a lot of health concerns, and one might note mad cow disease has given them a great deal of reason to be skeptical of any novel practice in the food that they consume, which has indeed fired their resistance to eating genetically engineered foods as well, whether it's been scientifically proven or not that it is harmful. Now, under the World Trade Organization's Agreement on Sanitary and Phytosanitary Standards, known as the SPS Agreement, which in ordinary language means the Food Safety Agreement, this SPS agreement says that for a country under WTO rules to legitimately create a barrier to trade, they must prove that the using sound science, they must prove that there is a known harm. And they must, if they've proven that, then put in place a policy that is the least trade restrictive to solve the problem. Now, there have been a slew of other cases that revolve around these issues. Basically, this least trade restrictive thing means that if you can put a label on a product so that consumers then have a choice, this is less trade restrictive than banning the product outright. Well, the Europeans lost that case in the WTO's dispute settlement body. Went to the appellate court. It went through several years of a very complicated legal process. But in the end, the Europeans lost. The reason was that they had not done an adequate risk assessment, scientifically based, to prove that these artificial growth hormones really and truly are bad to human health. Well, they started doing another risk assessment, more modern, and I'm not sure what the science would be that would somehow be better or more sound, but they are trying to develop another one. Meantime, consumer objections to eating this beef have been so severe that instead of changing their laws, which is the normal result of a decision against your policy, you change your laws to conform with WTO rules. Instead, what they did was say, all right, we will pay the penalty. We will allow the United States to put retaliatory tariffs on a whole list of products, Roquefort cheese and luxury leather goods and pork products, and a long list of European exports now get charged an extra high price when they enter this country, which our consumers then have to pay. If you want to eat Roquefort cheese, the price is quite a bit higher now, and the Roquefort producers have lost a lot of sales as a result. Well, that's the solution to the beef hormone situation, at least the way it stands right now. How that would apply to GMOs, genetically modified organisms, remains to be seen. But whether or not they will actually bring a case, some people are doubtful, because especially after Seattle, the WTO's legitimacy is in many respects so fragile that if the European Union were to lose a dispute about genetically engineered foods in the next few years, the reaction in Europe would probably be so extreme that the WTO would never be able to carry on its work legitimately, and it could just fall apart. Now, that rationale was actually told to me by an official of one of the European governments. We'll see what happens. Meanwhile, Europe isn't alone. Japan now has laws on the labeling of genetically engineered foods. So do Australia and New Zealand. Korea as well. These are labeling laws. The Monsanto company has recently let it be known that they expect to put a genetically engineered wheat product on the market. As you know, most products now are corn and soybeans that are commercially grown so far. Well, in preparation for this release into the marketplace of a genetically engineered wheat, the United States Wheat Associates did a survey of their customers in other countries. And the information, this is very recent, the information they got back was that no, in Japan, in the rest of Asia, in Egypt, our number one customer for wheat, they don't want genetically engineered foods. So it's spread into more of a universal reaction. The Wheat Associates Board has a committee on biotechnology that issued this survey, and in tabulating the results, they came up with a one-sentence conclusion that they published on March 15th. And the conclusion reads as follows. The United States wheat industry commits itself absolutely to the principle that our customers' needs and requirements are the most important consideration. End of document. Now, Brazil is gearing up to supply the world with genetically engineered free, GM-free foods, in particular soy. They hope that they can take advantage of this market and get plenty of revenues into their economy, but they have a particular problem, which is that Argentina, their neighbor, is outside of the United States the most advanced country in the development of genetically engineered crops. So Argentina, 80% of all the soybeans in Argentina right now are genetically engineered. Brazil, right across the border, wants to be GMO-free. I'm not sure how they're going to resolve this, but as I am sure you're aware, the threat of genetic pollution means that not only could Brazil lose the opportunity to fulfill the market niche that's been created as a result of the consumers worldwide, but so too farmers in the United States who want to go organic, or those farmers in the United States who are perceiving that they're losing their markets by planting genetically engineered crops, or those farmers in the United States who are discovering that the supposed benefits of planting GMOs are beginning to fade away. All of these trends that I think bode well for a healthy planet and a healthy economy worldwide are threatened by the fact that genetically engineered pollens are proliferating and being blown about by the wind quite freely because we've gone ahead and marketed these products before we've really examined the ecological problems, let alone the economic and social problems. The Biosafety Protocol, which you may have heard of, it's an international law that was just adopted in January of this year in Montreal. But it's called the Cartagena Biosafety Protocol because a year ago in the city of Cartagena, Colombia, they had a huge failure, much like Seattle, although it wasn't quite as popular yet. But there was an absolute breakdown in those international negotiations over the question of whether commodities, that's what we're talking about, the grain crops that we now sell in the commercial marketplace, whether these commodities should be governed by the same rules as experimental genetically engineered crops or seed crops or those laboratory-contained crops, which are now by law subject to the biosafety protocol, which is a series of procedural rules on how a particular importing country can get around that WTO requirement not to set up a trade barrier. They can get around that requirement by following these rules properly. And that means a thorough risk assessment. It means notifying the seller, or should I say the exporting country, most often the United States government, that they don't want to import a new commercial product that's genetically engineered, And they don't want to do so for the following reasons, and that they are engaging in a scientifically sound risk assessment process, and the results of that risk assessment may not be in yet, but based on the precautionary principle that better safe than sorry, we don't know whether or not there's real damage that these crops can cause either to ecosystems or to human beings who eat them. For all those reasons, we, the importing country, choose for the time being not to accept your imports. So if they follow all those rules, supposedly it would be legal for them under international law to say no and ban the import. Well, the United States and Argentina and four other countries that are developing genetically engineered crops, those six countries call themselves the Miami Group. They met in Miami and they got their coalition together and they stood together through these negotiations. They succeeded in putting quite a lot of loopholes into this new biosafety protocol, but nonetheless, it exists. The issue of commodities remains kind of halfway in. That was one of the biggest loopholes. And specifically on commodities, the shipments have to say that they may contain GMOs, but there is not any segregation, and therefore it's impossible to trace whether any particular shipping container does or doesn't have GMOs in it. Now, that's not to say Brazil or a particular community can't market GMO-free. They can, but there's no way for an importing country to know if the commercial trade in soy and corn, in particular, soon wheat, contains this stuff or not. That loophole will probably be ironed out in the next few years. One of the most important things about this biosafety protocol is that it exists. There is now an international framework for developing continually improved laws and policies based on sound science, based on the precautionary principle into the future. Now, I'm not a scientist. However, for the time being, I believe that it's appropriate to be opposed to commercializing genetically engineered foods and other transgenic organisms. And I would say so on the precautionary grounds that I've mentioned. I would also say so on ethical grounds. I would very firmly say so on economic and social and cultural grounds. And so far, the environmental evidence is coming in more and more every month that also on environmental grounds, these particular products have some risks. The way it works, I was asked to try to explain how it works. So as a non-scientist, and I'm sure some of you here will be able to explain this far better than I, but I think what they do in the lab is basically they take two species, and then from one species, like let's say a flounder fish, which grows deep in the ocean and is relatively used to cold weather or cold water, they take a gene out of that fish somehow. I'm not sure about how that happens. And then they put it in a gun. I understand it's really very much like a gun. And it's loaded into a tungsten bullet. I think these bullets are maybe some other heavy metals as well. Gold and tungsten. And so this bullet of a heavy metal is filled with this DNA from a flounder or bacterias or choleras or scorpions or things like that. And then they shoot the gun, and the bullet goes into the cells of the other species that they hope to have resistance to cold weather or cold water. And there is also involved in this process, bacteria are often used. Somehow bacteria are particularly handy for getting the gene from one thing into another thing. And you can't see this, it's all invisible, so they use something called markers, which happen to be antibiotic. And so you got heavy metals and bacteria and antibiotics all being shot into this new species, or the second species, sorry, to create some kind of a transgenic creature. Well, very unscientific explanation, but scientists, many, many increasingly more scientists are making the case that there are some problems with all of that. And something called pleiotropic effects are a major unresolved issue with transgenic experiments. Pleiotropic effects are these secondary unintended effects. So, okay, you wanted it to be resistant to cold weather or cold water, but the way genes interact, you know, it's like a complicated ecosystem with a lot of different interactions. It's not linear. And so you get unintended effects, particularly if you're only using lab experiments, so you're only controlling for the effect you want. You're not looking for and you don't find the effects you don't want. A case that I heard about really struck me. Scientist at the State University of Oregon was trying to use a genetically engineered bacteria to speed up the rate at which agricultural wastes could be converted into ethanol. Now, that sounds pretty good. I believe in ethanol as an alternative agriculturally based fuel. But what happened is the lab experiments went great, and she did all the field experiments that were required by the Environmental Protection Agency, and they were within weeks of putting this product on the market, in the commercial marketplace, to be bought and sold by anyone. And she and her graduate student did one extra research out in the field, and what they found out was that the bacteria did its job very well in terms of converting the waste to ethanol, but it also killed a fungus in the soil that was essential for all plants to bring nitrogen up through their root systems from soils. So that if this product had been sold and had been purchased and released by farmers or gas developers, there would have been more or less of a desert effect for who knows what distance as the fungus is killed in these soils. So that case really struck home for me. And so this is something called pleiotropic effects. There was a lawsuit against the Food and Drug Administration of the United States government arguing that the FDA's policies weren't sufficient to test new transgenic foods. And in the discovery process, 44,000 pages of documentation from inside the FDA was made public. And among those pages of documents came out memoranda from the scientists within the FDA, many of whom argued that these pleiotropic effects were of deep concern to them, and they were not satisfied with the FDA's policies. Now, what are those FDA policies? Basically, they say that a company should do its own risk assessments of a product it is developing, and that if that company feels that there are some safety risks, then that company should notify the FDA, and then they'll regulate it. So it's an entirely voluntary, corporate-based approach to risk assessment that our federal government likes to say at all these international meetings I go to is the best in the world. And of course the United States public has complete reliance on the adequacy of our food and drug testing. I can go on and on. The FDA just Tuesday was faced with another legal petition in the courts by 50 organizations saying that as a result of that, those findings, we want to see more stringent pre-market testing for all GMO products before they are commercialized. In other words, we'd like the FDA to take very stringent measures. There's a revolving door in government between the private sector and the public sectors. And this is a big part of our story. The revolving door behind the Food and Drug Administration, there are any number of examples, but the one that comes to my mind is a gentleman named Michael Taylor, who has been in and out of the FDA. He had the job of writing the policy about the RBGH milk. Remember the genetically engineered milk product, the drug that they shot the cows up with so that they would produce more milk? And they argued that this milk was completely fine for human beings. And the gentleman who ruled that it was inappropriate for a dairy to put the label saying GMO-free on their products, that instead they had to follow a very lengthy and precise text that said the milk from cows treated with RBGH is no different from the milk from cows that is not treated with RBGH, something like that. That gentleman, Michael Taylor, when he's out of government, he works for a law firm, the King & Spalding Law Firm in Atlanta, Georgia, and his client, among his clients, is the Monsanto Company, who is the producer of this particular product. Back to this public interest and private interest business. Business. We just use that term, you know, for everything. Is that a coincidence? Public sector science and private sector science. The United States Department of Agriculture spends $1 billion a year on R&D, research and development, for agricultural biotechnologies now. $1 billion a year, roughly, is the budget. The budget within USDA for risk assessment of agricultural biotechnologies is $1 million within our agriculture department. Now, of course, within private industry, Monsanto or Novartis or you name it, you can be sure that the budget is even more skewed. What they spend on R&D versus what they spend on risk assessment is probably even more disproportionate. I don't know how many of you know the poem by Robert Frost called "The Path Not Taken." If you don't go that way now, when you come to the fork in the road, you'll never go that way, because by then, you're that way. And this came out in the nuclear versus renewables debate a couple decades ago. The term the hard path and the soft path was talked about a great deal. If we're putting all of our scientific eggs in the high-tech basket, I'll go further. If we're putting all of our scientific eggs in the genetic engineering basket, it's very unlikely that we'll put sufficient investment into alternative research that could enable us to find other ways to feed the world, increase yield, develop drought-resistant varieties, and so forth. All those values that are attributed to genetic engineering could also be developed otherwise. A case in point, many of you have heard of this new vitamin A rice, the so-called golden rice. Somehow it's all over the media, even though at the moment it's only a couple of seeds that have grown into plants that did what they wanted them to do. This vitamin A rice quality has not yet been bred into the kind of rice varieties that grow in Asia, even though they talk about feeding all the people who are deficient in vitamin A, particularly in Asia. And there have been no field tests yet, and they also don't even know if the vitamin A in this rice can be absorbed by the human organism after eating it. The absorption itself requires certain interactions that they're not sure can be transferred in this fashion. But when you talk to people from Asia who work with peasant farmers there, what they say is that the reason that the Asians are deficient in vitamin A has to do with that famous Green Revolution of the 70s. The transformation of a peasant agricultural system into monocultural agriculture systems has forced people to give up their small subsistence plots where they could grow a wide variety of vegetables to make sure that they had a wide variety of nutrients that a healthy human being requires. Another problem with this is that if you're deficient in vitamin A, you're likely deficient in a whole bunch of other micronutrients. So vitamin A rice is not going to solve all those other nutritional problems that poor people have around the world. I would argue that the soft path that's really needed to solve nutritional problems in Asia or anywhere else is ensuring that families have access to land, water, and seeds. Now, why all the hype? Why are we hearing so much about this experimental vitamin A rice? I would make the case that it has to do with a response to the public's reaction all around the world to the Roundup Ready soybeans and the BT corn products, which are already in the commercial marketplace and which have no agronomic value whatsoever. That critique is strong enough that the promoters of these genetic engineering practices and products felt like they had to get something out there into the public that sounds good, that sounds like it really does address a serious human problem. This feed the world myth has another flaw in it as well, I would argue. If you put a map of where United States food exports go on top of a map showing where people are hungry, they don't match. So the notion that we're going to grow genetically engineered crops that then the people in the hungry parts of the world will eat and become healthy again, it doesn't wash. In fact, to the contrary, overproduction in the United States and the exporting of these cheap foods because of our overproduction, having driven the price down, is forcing producers in these countries out of the marketplace. They can't compete against these cheap U.S. foods, and so they lose their market, they lose their land, they go into the cities, they become part of the urban poor. Food insecurity is a direct result of United States exports. So United States exports are not likely to solve the problem. The soft path. Erie, the International Rice Research Institute, one of 16 gene banks where public interest scientists are trying to develop alternatives to or new varieties that can fulfill the goals of increased yield, increased nutritional quality, adaptation to climate change, etc. They, through traditional breeding methods, not genetic engineering, have produced something called a super rice that is expected to be marketable by the year 2004. It's a great deal further along the experimental and testing path than the so-called vitamin A rice, and is already showing the promise of increasing yields by 10 to 20%. If we really invested in public interest research and development, the potential to solve the many problems that we all worry about is real. We need to support on-farm research, not just laboratory research, but actually research in the poor parts of the world on the farms where the people who live in those communities actually work and grow food. On-farm research is a key to the soft path development. Now, what is not good for the farmers is good to Cargill and Monsanto and the other agribusiness companies that are behind all this hype. From 1976 to 1997, 21 years, in the United States, each farmer who spent a dollar on hybrid corn seed got an average of a $3 return on that dollar. Now, that's not to say that all their other costs, chemicals and paying the rent and so forth, didn't add up to more than $3. I'm not saying they made a 300% profit, But just on the investment of the hybrid corn seed, it was a 1-to-3 ratio return for the farmer. Since the introduction of the GMO corn seeds from 1995 to 1997, only a 3-year analysis, that return has diminished. Every $1 spent on a GMO seed, which is, of course, higher priced, they only get a $1.24 return. There's no agronomic benefit. We're finding out that there are yield drags, in fact, on Roundup Ready soybeans, 5% on average in the last 3 or 4 years. On the BT corn, the corn borer is an episodic pest, and so the farmer buys this higher-priced corn seed every year, but really only needs it 1 out of 4 years. So there's an extra expense there. Purdue University just this year has a new study showing that that's not generating, over a time period, value for the farmers. And of course, as the insects and the weeds are developing resistance to the Roundup and Roundup Ready and to the BT toxins, farmers are having to invest in the chemicals anyway. So the so-called solution of a chemical-free approach to pest resistance is also turning out not to be true. Farmers are also suing each other. The organic farmers are suing their conventional farm neighbors because of the genetic pollution problem. There are increasing numbers of court cases, neighbor against neighbor. The farmers that are saving their seed in violation of their licensing contracts with Monsanto Company, which says if you buy GMO seed, you can't save it and reuse it, contrary to the practices of farmers since time immemorial. Neighbor against neighbor. The Pinkerton Detective Agency has been on the job to try to find those farmers who are violating these patent laws. The beneficiaries of this are the Monsanto Company, the Cargill Company, and so forth. Corporate concentration, one of the most challenging problems in our economy today. As of now, Monsanto and the DuPont Company, between them, control 73% of all seed corn companies in the United States. Monsanto just bought Cargill's entire seed distribution system worldwide, with the exception of North America, enabling them to take these untested, potentially problematic products, these seeds, and distribute them all over the world. The farmers' rally Tuesday in Washington, D.C., I don't know how many of you saw the news about that, but one of their 5 campaign demands was strict enforcement of existing United States law against corporate conglomerates. The antitrust laws are not being enforced, even though they're on the books. The merger between the Cargill and Continental companies, you know, the number one and number two grain companies in the world, is about to be approved. The Department of Justice, just in the last week or so, published its recommendation that now the law judges will have to deal with, saying that, yes, they should go ahead and allow the merger. The divestiture of 10 of their facilities around the country, because those 10 would have gone over the edge between what was supposedly too much concentration in the industry. Of those 10 divestitures that have already occurred, 5 were bought by the number 4 grain company in the world, the Louis Dreyfus Corporation. So how this really increases competition and solves the problems that farmers face when the buyers of their products own enough of the facility that they can control the price, a cartel, so to speak, is beyond my understanding. The Foundation for Economic Trends, Jeremy Rifkin's nonprofit organization, has filed suit on behalf of all farmers all over the world. It's the first global class action suit in history. This suit is now in the United States court system, and he charges Monsanto, Novartis, DuPont, some 9 of the so-called life science companies, the agribusiness, chemical, and pharmaceutical merged companies, with conspiring to create a cartel. And if you read his briefs, it's quite interesting to see what smoking guns they have found to make the case that they've conspired to form a cartel. Jeremy Rifkin predicts that that lawsuit will begin to be argued and will get into our media in a way that's going to be even bigger than the Microsoft case. And I look forward to reading those articles very much. Monsanto is very active in the rest of the world. It has formed agreements with a number of private foundations to bring genetically engineered technologies to Africa in particular, but also to elsewhere, in order to feed the hungry and allow them to bring themselves out of poverty. The United States AID, AID, Agency for International Development, just recently gave Mozambique, where these tremendous floods are killing thousands and thousands of people, a huge quantity of seeds to help them to rebuild their agriculture. Anyone want to bet that those are genetically engineered seeds? I don't know that for a fact, but I take a bet. It's not a coincidence that Africa has led the opposition to the United States and the rest of the Miami Group in various international negotiations to try to defend biodiversity and biosafety. The Ethiopians in particular have led the entire African group in this initiative. I don't think it's a coincidence that Ethiopia is very, very familiar with famine. Oddly enough, they also have one of the most, if not the most, sophisticated gene bank in the world. And they are striving mightily to develop the soft path towards food security and development. Whether or not they will be allowed to do so, as the United States and these agribusiness chemical pharmaceutical conglomerates market their wares and use these international institutions to force other countries to allow these products into their markets and into their ecosystems, remains to be seen. Food security really fundamentally depends on genetic diversity. Even though here in Ithaca and in Minnesota and in a whole lot of universities around the United States, there are scientists using materials from the other gene banks, Fort Collins, the United States big gene bank, public sector, and the other ones that make up this international system of agricultural research centers, they depend on renewing their stock with wild varieties every so often. If there are no wild varieties with which to commingle through traditional breeding methods, getting fresh DNA into a more narrow stock that has been contained for some time, not allowed to evolve along with climate change and soil conditions and so forth out there in nature. If we lose that genetic base in the wild, it's very unlikely that our scientists can continue to develop the kind of improved varieties that we assume are the basis of the food system. Biopiracy, the taking of those wild varieties by corporations using anthropologists and other sorts of researchers who enjoy going into these remote areas, getting to know the local people, getting to know their religious and food and health medicinal practices, and taking the plants that they discover through those communications with the local people back to the laboratory, and then taking the active ingredients, developing a synthetic, marketing a product, whether we're talking about a food product or a pharmaceutical. This is being called biopiracy now by those countries who are beginning to recognize the incredible value of their wild gene pools. There are numerous cases. 147 have been documented by RAFI, the Rural Advancement Foundation International, cases in which the local knowledge of indigenous or other traditional peoples has been taken back to the laboratory and patented, made the private property of the corporation that had the resources and wherewithal to send the anthropologist out and bring back the material and do some tinkering around with the genes so that they could declare some kind of a novel invention that makes it a legitimate patentable product under United States patent law. This is being called biopiracy. One of the most egregious cases, I don't know how many of you saw it, was reported in the New York Times recently, in which a company called Podners, based in the United States, in 1994, only 6 years ago, went to Mexico and bought a bunch of yellow beans in the market. And they came back to the United States and they selected among those yellow beans for the most yellow ones. And after 5 or 6 years of this selection process, they had a really super yellow bean, and then they patented it. And they said, this yellow bean now belongs to the Podners company, and if the Mexicans have any beans that are quite that yellow in their stock, they owe a royalty now to this company. Well, Mexico is getting kind of interested in this patent, and there may well be a dispute. We'll see about that. Now, the whole concept of intellectual property rights and patents has a great deal of merit. The other side of the coin is the argument I'm going to make here, in particular related to life forms. There's something questionable ethically about privatizing something that's living and declaring that it is the private property of a single corporation and that no one else can use that life form for any purpose without paying the patent holder some royalties. An example that I would like to, I guess, make here, and this is getting me towards the end of my comments, would be the Pfizer Pharmaceutical Company, which is, you know, one of the very, very, very giant companies, has been developing some AIDS drugs, and they have got a patent on this new drug called Diflucan, which shows a great deal of promise for helping AIDS victims to survive. They, in South Africa, well, this is information from the Nobel Prize-winning nonprofit organization Doctors Without Borders, Médecins Sans Frontières. The Pfizer company invested $3 billion in South Africa on the development of Diflucan and has already earned $6 billion on sales of this drug. And they're producing it in Thailand. Each pill, I guess it's a pill, costs 3 rand. And they're selling it in South Africa for 36 rand each. So there's some very, very huge orders of magnitude here in terms of the actual costs and the actual revenues that the Pfizer company is earning on this drug against AIDS. When you have a patent, no other company, unless they pay you, can develop that same technology. And increasingly, researchers are not releasing the information that they learn along the research way because they want to be first in line for the patent. I'm sure many of you are familiar with this problem. Here in the universities, there's a serious trend against publishing early in order to make sure that the university itself is the first one to the patent office. This undermines the ostensible objective of intellectual property rights, which is to stimulate innovation in order to reach the goal of curing AIDS or curing cancer or what have you. It's a reversal of the entire incentive structure for which intellectual property rights were designed. I'd suggest that there is an alternative model that we might consider. I don't know how many of you are familiar with the electric utility regulatory system in this country, but they have a so-called natural monopoly, and one company serves a very large area, and there's no competition. So the basis on which our government has decided that they should be regulated so that they're not taking advantage of that monopoly to rip off the public is that each state in the United States creates a public utility commission or a public service commission or something like that. They're often elected, they're often appointed by other public officials, but it is a public body, and on an annual basis they bring the company into a public meeting and they request the company to open up their books. And not to give away any trade secrets, but to demonstrate what their investments in research have been, what their investments have been in new plant and facility, to really show that the money that they collect from the consumers is actually put into providing service to the consumers. And if the company is doing a good job of that, then this public agency says, "You're a great company. You get a good reward. 14% return on investment above and beyond your costs." And then that's averaged out for the number of ratepayers in a particular service area, and that's what we pay to have electricity. The same thing could be done with pharmaceuticals or other kinds of research and development needs in the public interest. In Seattle, one of the issues that didn't get much media attention was the intellectual property rights issue. And the one success there, although since the entire meeting was derailed, it's not on the books, but it will be carried forward, was that all of the governments agreed that there should not be patents on the list of essential drugs that the United Nations World Health Organization lists as essential to human health. That's a major change to say that those drugs should not be patented. Remains to be transferred into actual implementable law, but we shall see. The other hot issue in the intellectual property rights negotiations is whether or not there should be patents on seeds and patents on plants and patents on animals and patents on human beings. There are some already. These negotiations are ongoing. After Seattle, there's a whole new spirit, and there are governments prepared to hold the line. Once again, it's the African governments that have taken the strongest position and argued that the World Trade Organization should prohibit all patents on life. After Seattle, there's a whole discussion that's opened up about the nature of global governance. Should a multilateral institution have as much power as the WTO has to overrule national governments who, through their domestic democratic procedures in Congress or in Parliament, through administrative procedures, through the painstaking give and take of our public debate, should those decisions made in a democracy be overruled by an institution that is fundamentally anti-democratic? On the other hand, there are times in which an international decision does need to be made and does need to be applicable worldwide. I would cite climate change as perhaps the most obvious of those issues. We truly need a global process for figuring out how to deal with certain global problems. There's a big agenda of international meetings coming up later this year, in Geneva, there's ongoing negotiations around the WTO issues. In France, in November or December, there will be the first meeting to follow up on the new International Biosafety Protocol. In Nairobi, in May, there will be the fifth conference of the parties to the Convention on Biological Diversity, where the issues of indigenous peoples' rights and how traditional knowledge can and should be juxtaposed to intellectual property rights. Those negotiations are in May in Nairobi. Also in May in Dresden, the CGR, the consultative group on international agricultural research, the collection of these 16 gene banks, they will be having their annual meeting, and it will be preceded by a meeting with the non-governmental sectors from all over the world to talk about the role of agricultural research in particular and the distinction between public interest science and private interest science is at the top of that list. Increasingly, all over the world, GMOs and genetic engineering is at the heart of all of these negotiations. Consumers and environmentalists, farmers, both conventional farmers and certainly peasant farmers where they have an organizational voice, are saying they don't want GMOs. I would argue that it's not hysteria, and I would argue that it's even not really about science. It's about the structure of our economies, the future of our societies. It's about the survival of the planet and the survival of cultures, the relationship of people to their land and resources. It's the battle royale of the 21st century. Science has a very crucial role to play in how this unfolds. Whether it can stand the privatization challenge is the question that we have before us. C.P. Snow asked this question in 1959, whether by the year 2000 we will have solved the problem of poverty through our scientific knowledge. So far, the answer is quite obviously no. 41 years later, I'll close by quoting the Anglican Archbishop of Cape Town, the Most Reverend Nyongokulu Winston Hugh Ndungani. I'm not sure that that's how it's pronounced. It's my best shot at it. He wrote in a letter dated March 13th of the year 2000, just a week ago, to the chairman and chief executive officer of the Pfizer company, Mr. William C. Steer, Jr. I only quote a sentence or two. "Creativity is needed to bridge the huge gap between human need, scientific effort, and market returns. Both rich and poor need to direct their attention towards a common plan of action regarding mobilization of science and technology for poor country problems." 41 years after C.P. Snow, it sounds very similar. How about it? Do we think that by the year 2041, 41 years from now, we will have solved the problem of poverty in this world? Let's teach our children well. Thank you very much.